Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. This morning we'll have another conversation about energy policy in the United States and talk about some of the recommendations that the Bush administration has made. We've done a couple of shows on this topic this week, and it was very clear that the guests that we had were critical of the president's approach. In the interest of providing some balance and range of opinions on the issues, this morning we'll be talking with Myron Ebel from the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and the institute has been quite supportive of the president and his approach. Myron Ebel oversees all global warming and international environmental work at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. In fact, he's director of global warming and international environmental policy. So certainly, I'm sure he'll have some things to say about that, and I'm sure he would respond to whatever questions, comments people have as we talk here over the next hour or so. The telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you may use that number and we will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, people who are listening are certainly welcome to call. The only thing we ask of callers is that you try to be brief in your comments so that we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Ebel, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
At the time that the president started talking about his energy plan, your institute put out a press release, and one of the quotes here comes from you, and you said that the energy plan released today, meaning on the 17th of May, represents an important move away from the disastrous anti-energy policies of the last decade. And I'd like to start by asking you, if you could talk a little bit about in what ways you think, indeed, the policies of the previous administration were anti-energy.
Yes, I think that's absolutely the right place to start, because we have gotten into the energy problems that we now have because of very consistently pursued policies by the Clinton-Gore administration to lower energy production, constrict energy supplies, and raise energy prices. Now, they never articulated these aims because, of course, most people would be opposed to raising energy prices and having scarce energy. But this agenda fit in very well with the environmental agenda of the Clinton-Gore administration, which is that, in the first place, alternative energy sources such as windmills and other renewable technologies can't become competitive price-wise until conventional energy gets more expensive. So we have to raise the price of energy. Secondly, of course, is the issue of global warming. And as you know, Vice President Gore was, he may not have invented the internet, but he did pretty much invent global warming. And he really truly believes that people have to use a lot less energy, particularly fossil fuel energy, and raising prices is clearly the way to do that. So the previous administration spent a lot of time throwing up supply bottlenecks in particular. On the supply of energy production, they, you know, roped off millions and millions of acres of federal land from oil and gas exploration. They closed down the largest deposit of clean coal in the United States and the second largest in the world. But really what they focused on were the supply system. The permitting process for building natural gas pipelines was tightened up, for example. No new oil refineries have been built in this country for a long time, but the oil refiners have gotten around that by upgrading existing refineries. The Clinton-Gore administration put in place new regulations which make it virtually impossible to upgrade existing oil refineries. Those are the kinds of bottlenecks that they sought to put into the system, and we're now paying the price for that in terms of energy shortages, rolling blackouts, higher prices. And I think the the Bush plan is a U-turn away from that approach.
Mm-hmm. So just in short, if I'm understanding what you're saying, that you're saying that the goal of the previous administration was they were concerned about the quality of the environment. Their answer to protecting the environment was to try to cut down on energy use, and their chief way of getting people to cut down on energy use was to do what they could do to make energy more expensive.
Yes, that's an excellent summary.
Let me ask you, because many environmentalists, one of their chief criticisms of the administration's approach is its continued reliance on fossil fuels, on petroleum, on coal, on natural gas, that as a result of their burning end up putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, one of those things that has been identified as being important in global warming, something that many people feel is a problem, is a continuing problem, and we should be doing something about. And I wonder how it is, and this applies specifically to this area that I know you're interested in and work in, global warming. What do you think about that criticism that says this is the wrong approach because we're still relying so much on fossil fuels, and the reason that's wrong is that it contributes to global warming?
Well, we may have to have a long excursus here into global warming, but in terms of the Bush administration putting together their energy plan, I think that they were simply recognizing reality, that in terms of the United States' energy needs and demands, there would be no way to satisfy these demands by trying to suppress fossil fuel consumption. Mm. It's just too big a chunk of the total. And I think Vice President Cheney put it very well when he said, to address the problems that have been created, and I don't have an exact quote, he said that we can't concentrate on any one sector of the energy mix. We have to have the entire mix. So we can't get rid of nuclear. We can't get rid of hydropower. We have to count on more alternative technologies. We have to count on technological progress. But we also still have to rely on fossil fuels. Now, it's clear that technological advances can perhaps change that. But the administration clearly recognizes that they can't change direction on a dime, that it's going to take two or three decades, not two or three years, to move out of fossil fuels into other energy sources. And one of the problems that is always we face in dealing with criticisms of this is the idea that there's off-the-shelf technology already available that will allow us to do all kinds of other things. The problem is, yes, there's lots of advanced technology available that for special applications will allow us to do lots of other things. But at the cost that people, in order to provide affordable energy, these off-the-shelf technologies right now are very expensive. They're there, but they're not ready to build big power plants or to change the electrical grid to a local system where people generate electricity in their backyards. That may come, but you know, to meet today's needs and build power plants now requires making massive capital investments right now for the next 20, 30 years. We can't wait 10 or 15 years for some technological advance. Hmm.
I have some callers here I want to get right to, and I promise that these folks I'm not going to make them wait forever.
Good.
And as you say, I don't really think we want to turn the program into a program about global warming, which it easily could.
Yeah,
but
right.
I do want to ask you your reaction to this report that just was announced yesterday. This is a report that was written by a number of atmospheric sciences who are members of the National Academy of Sciences. And here I'll just read from part of the story here. This was in the New York Times yesterday, and the story reads, "Today's report reflects the increasing certainty of the scientific community here and abroad that the warming of the last 50 years is probably because of the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations. The panel said the degree of confidence in this conclusion was, quote, higher today than it was 10 or even 5 years ago. And the headline on the story is, panel tells Bush global warming is getting worse. What do you think about this report?
Well, I think that that news account is really wrong, but I know why it's wrong. The report was very cleverly put together in order to both fan the flames of global warming alarmism, but also be scientifically respectable. The first few paragraphs of the summary are very broad brush and very unqualified, and they no doubt will be, the report will be waved around by global warming alarmists as this is the final proof, you know, the top scientists in the country have affirmed it. In fact, the report, if you go through it and read it, qualifies all of those big statements with all sorts of uncertainties and conditions and areas of doubt. So I think, for example, one of the questions they were asked was to review the United Nations reports on global warming and compare them to the summaries that are prepared, the so-called summaries for policymakers. The reports themselves are thousands of pages. The summary for policymakers are 10, 15, 20 pages. They said that, well, for the most part, they did, the summaries did accurately represent the full report. But the key word is mostly. Most of the claims in the summaries are substantiated in the report. They left out, they didn't give us the detail, but they left open the possibility that most could be, you know, 51% of the claims and the rest are not substantiated. The report is full of those kinds of qualifications and admissions of uncertainty. So I think that, you know, the scientists on the panel have tried to really have it both ways. They've tried to stoke the fuels of popular passion while still remaining respectable scientists.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Myron Ebel. He is Director of Global Warming and International Environmental Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the Bush energy proposals. We've been talking about that on a number of programs over the last week or so. Mostly we've been hearing from people who were critical. We wanted to provide you a different point of view, give you the opportunity to hear from the guest, ask questions, and you're welcome to do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have two people here ready to go. We'll start off with Peoria, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Ebel, I'm not familiar with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. How long has that been around?
It was founded in 1984 by our president, Fred Smith.
Fred Smith. And you're the director of global warming?
Yes.
Okay. And how many people are on staff there?
Oh, about 35.
35. And how do you, is it a nonprofit?
Yes, we're a nonprofit public policy institute.
And could you tell me who your five largest contributors are?
No, I can't because I don't know, but I can tell you that our annual budget is over $3 million, and we receive approximately one-third from individuals, one-third from corporations, and one-third from charitable foundations.
And who would some of those individuals and corporations be?
I don't know. I don't pay any attention to that stuff.
You don't know? You don't know who pays your salary?
Yes, the Competitive Enterprise Institute pays my salary.
David, this is something that I've been meaning to mention. And, you know, you have to find spokespeople where you can. But in the future, I think you'd be doing all of us a great service if we could find out who's paying for these institutes, think tanks, all of that. You know, to me, this just sounds like he's working for energy companies. And what's your background in environmental or global warming, Mr. Ebel?
Well, I've been following the issue since before the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated in 1997, and I've been actively involved in it.
What's your academic credentials?
I was an undergraduate at Colorado College. I was a graduate student at the University of California, San Diego.
Majoring in?
Philosophy, the London School of Economics, political theory, and Peterhouse Cambridge University in history.
Mm-hmm. Anything in environment or biology or anything like that?
Nope.
But you're willing and able and competent to say that these scientists are alarmists.
I think you have to understand that the science, when it meets public policy, is not a question just for the sort of the people who belong to the trade union. It's something that's open to all of us. I think any citizen of normal intelligence can understand these public policy issues, and I am one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have more qualifications than the average spokesman for an environmental group that you hear on the radio or on television.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as I'm concerned, when I hear someone representing an institute or a think tank, and they're either unable or unwilling to tell me who's funding them, then your credibility is really very low for me. So I'll hang up and listen to the rest of the program. It's very good. Thank you.
All right. Is that, Mr. Ebel, is that information available on the CEI website, or is it for people who are interested in that, is there some way to find that out?
I think under the IRS codes, people can request what's called our 990 form, which details some of the sort of larger areas of our fundraising. I should mention, as I said before, our budget is over $3 million a year. We get about equal amounts from corporations, charitable foundations, and individuals. I don't pay attention to who those people are. We don't accept grants from corporations or individuals that are tied to specific projects. It's just grants to the institution. So we don't tie our work to a particular contribution that we get.
Let's talk with someone else. In Urbana, the next person, line number two. Hello.
Yes, hi. I'm calling from my car phone for the very first time because I am, like the previous caller, absolutely infuriated at your speaker, who clearly is representing big buck oil corporations, is not a scientist, and who refuses to divulge who is funding his institute, which clearly has a conservative anti-environment bias. And it behooves everybody to check out this institute, and this speaker is without any scientific credentials. I'll hang up and let someone else pursue this matter, because clearly this is an outrage being perpetrated on the public by this institute.
Well, all right. I don't know.
Let me just reply to that briefly.
Sure.
I think that the ad hominem attack really has limited usefulness. It's really not where people come from, what they look like, what the color of their skin is, where they get their money. It's what they argue. And I think that the ad hominem attack is typically used by the left to try to tar people when in fact the left has no arguments to offer, no evidence to offer, no facts to offer. Now, as far as this big industry stuff, I work for a free market, a group that supports free markets, and I would just put it to your listeners that free markets are not something that big business or big bad industry likes, and free markets don't particularly benefit big bad business. Free markets benefit consumers because they allow the sort of competition between different products and services so that people can choose what they want to buy, and free markets also help to provide products that are of higher quality at a lower price than socialist markets. So I resent the tie to big industry. I would rather be tied to big consumers. that is the American people. But that's a matter of interpretation, so I'll leave it at that.
We're talking this morning with Myron Ebel. He is Director of Global Warming and International Environmental Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. We're talking about energy policy in this country, and your questions are welcome. And I really must say, Mr. Ebel, we didn't invite you on the program with the hope that people would attack you personally. We're doing the show, and I want to make sure people are listening know that we're doing the show specifically in response to listener comments about some of the other shows that we've been doing on looking at the Bush energy policy, saying that it was too one-sided, that it leaned to the left, and so we're trying to provide a different sort of point of view.
That's fine.
Questions are welcome.
I'm here for the punches.
All right. Well, let's go to some other callers here. Next is Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hardly know where to begin. you talked about competitiveness, and I would just point out that nuclear energy, which the Bush administration would like to push, wouldn't be, competitive at all if it weren't for massive subsidies that have been pumped into the industry, ever since the beginning and continue to this day, plus, these artificial protections that are given to them so they don't have to be responsible for, any damage that they might do to the environment and to communities. I just like the other callers, I find much of what you have to say just thoroughly ludicrous and unfounded. It's just astonishing.
Well, I absolutely agree with you that the nuclear industry has in the past received large amounts of subsidies because, of course, the nuclear industry providing us with electricity came out of Defense Department work on nuclear weapons. It is also true that the nuclear industry has liability protection under the Price-Anderson Act provided by the federal government. Now, I think I would say two things. First of all, I don't support any particular kind of energy. It seems to me that these are all competitors in the marketplace, and if one form of energy can provide a product at a better price and a higher quality, and that includes the environmental quality, then those people will win customers. The nuclear industry has received huge amounts of subsidies in the past. It isn't receiving those subsidies now. So it seems to me what we're talking about is future power needs, not what happened in the 1960s or 70s. As for the Price-Anderson Act, no, we don't support providing that kind of federally guaranteed liability protection to the nuclear industry, and I think it's a mistake, and I think it's one of the few real flaws in the Bush energy plan.
So you would actively pursue repealing Price-Anderson?
Yes, we have for a long time been opposed to Price-Anderson.
Well, then would you also say that other forms of energy should have to also be factored into them, the environmental cost, that somehow you need to factor in to, the cost on the environment of, pollution? You talk about a free market, but I think that you're, this is a very qualified sort of, free market. Most people, what they refer to in free market, they're talking about something that is skewed very much in particular ways.
Well, yes, the markets are skewed, and it's almost always that they're skewed by rent-seeking interests. One interest or another tries to go to government and get some special favor or subsidy. For instance, we also oppose federally subsidies to promote clean coal technology. We oppose the 1.7 cents per kilowatt hour subsidy to wind power. We oppose a whole range of government interventions in the market that we think provide special breaks to one big company or another. So I think we basically agree, but we may have a slight you know, there may be a slight attitude difference between us, but I basically agree with you. There is no call to subsidize clean coal technology or wind power. Let them compete in the market.
Well, I just find that the notion that the market uber all is to be ludicrous. I mean, if we know that we could promote something that could be very beneficial, why not put our resources into developing it? I mean, that notion, why have public education? Why, you know, and maybe you don't support the idea of public education, but, you know, I mean, there are public goods that we can put our resources to that, you know, can have a great benefit. And I just, you know, I don't know, I just find this all very, very ludicrous.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have some other folks here I want to get to. In fact, I'm losing people because I think I've been keeping them waiting too long.
I apologize.
No need for you to apologize. Let's go on to another caller, and I think this is Aurora and line number 4. Hello?
Yeah, I didn't hear a lot of the first part of the program, but I just want to say, and possibly what I'm going to say isn't it's how I feel, and possibly it doesn't fit into your program this morning. I don't understand who is a I'll just ask the questions and then I'll hang up. Who is a free market? Who? And then I guess I see America as a very gluttonous country. They take and take and take. They pollute and pollute and pollute. When are we going to decide that we've done enough? We have to step back. We have to tighten our belts. We have to do things differently so that we can fit into what the suffering that the rest of the world is doing. There's many, many countries that do not have what we have or even come close to it. Why do we have to have so much? Why can't we start tightening our belts again, as I said before? Why do we have to have so much in America and other countries have nothing?
Well, I appreciate the caller's comments, and I'm interested, I guess, in also trying to connect this to the energy issue.
Well, I think it does connect. I think it connects very clearly.
Well, it's also because it seems that part of the criticism of the Bush plan seemed to come from a feeling that the caller articulated, not just from people who maybe were strongly environmentalists, but the feeling that the caller articulated that says there really should be a strong place for conservation and efficiency in this whole thing, and they really faulted the administration for downplaying that so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are about three or maybe four issues here, and I'll try to address each one very briefly. First of all, in terms of environmental protection, the World Bank came out with an interesting study some time ago in which they showed very clearly that the countries in the world with the highest environmental quality were the richer countries. That is, the richer you are, the better environmental quality you have. So consequently, the best way for countries to improve their environmental condition is to first improve their economy so that they have a richer populace. Now, in this country, the reason we have such high environmental quality is because we are very wealthy. Now, many people feel that we're too wealthy and that somehow government should do something about that. I feel that there is something undemocratic and anti-consumer in this attitude, and I'm not quite sure why in the energy field government coercion is somehow acceptable to force us to consume less. It seems to me that these are private decisions. I'm all for conservation, and in fact I would associate myself with Vice President Cheney's remarks. Conservation is a laudable private virtue, but forcing conservation, there is something wrong with telling people that you must consume less because I think that's a good idea. I don't think that's how a democratic society should operate. It seems to me that if I want to consume less, I will. And of course, I and my family try to conserve in every way we can. And of course, there's an incentive for conservation of energy. It's called saving money when we go around turning out the lights when they're not needed, or we only own one car, even though we have several children, this is saving money. We're rewarded for our conservation efforts, and I think that's an important factor to keep in mind. The idea that somehow the American people should rise up and demand that everyone stop consuming so much, I think is really offensive. And I think it's ultimately based on the idea that coming out of the 1970s, where it was predicted because of the energy crises of the 1970s, which were largely caused by price controls, that we were running out of energy and that we had to save it, and people who used energy were wicked, and the more you used, the more wicked you were. Well, we're not running out of energy, and it's not wicked to use energy. It's the basis of our standard of living. Hmm. People live more comfortable, safer, and brighter lives because of energy use. And I don't see why, if you make X amount of money and you spend a certain percentage of it on energy, why you are somehow morally inferior because you spend more of your budget on energy than someone else does. If you typically people conserve, save energy, and they have budgets in their household to save a lot of money, and then they spend it on a trip or something. Well, a trip uses a lot of energy too. Or they invest it. Well, investment goes to capital in our infrastructure, and a lot of that investment goes to our energy infrastructure. So I don't see the distinction between energy use and other kinds of consumption, and I think there's really something offensive about people saying that we must force the government to force people to use less energy.
We're moving into our last 15 minutes of the program. I have three people on hold. I want to try to get them all, and
yes.
People
yep.
can help us if they can try to kind of be brief. We'll just go right at it, and the next person in line is Urbana, line number two.
Oh, hello. Hi.
Yes.
I just have a quick question. You said alternative energy is not competitive, particularly wind. Could you give me some figures on the price per kilowatt hour of wind? I could actually give you some prices and compare those with coal or oil.
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I'm sorry. I didn't speak very clearly. I'm saying if wind power isn't competitive, there is no reason why taxpayers should be giving it a 1.7 cents per kilowatt hour subsidy, which is what it currently has. Similarly, if coal has to have a subsidy in order to promote clean coal research and clean coal technology research, then it's not being competitive. I'm not against wind power, and I think it's becoming more competitive every day.
You spoke
more and more of it,
I know those
figures and
tax incentives for clean coal, and is giving tax incentives for oil companies, and is giving tax incentives for other fossil fuels and for nuclear power. So actually, you do not support the Bush energy plan.
Yes, that's a very good question. I support what I think is the main focus of the Bush energy plan, which is to remove bottlenecks in the supply system so that it's once again possible to build natural gas power pipelines, electricity transmission lines, new oil refineries, and new power plants.
Those are going to be using eminent domain to take away private lands in order to build those transmission lines. Should those be fairly paid for? And if we're going to be taking away private land or using public dollars, shouldn't we be using that to promote, say, wind, which we could probably get at 5 or 6 cents a kilowatt hour here?
Yeah, there is a problem with wind, but I'll try to say it just very briefly, which is, it's competitive per kilowatt hour, but it requires utilities to make a double capital investment because they have to invest in a baseload plant and then they have to invest in wind, which is intermittent and unpredictable. But leaving that aside, I do not support what I think are the minor elements in the Bush plan, which are subsidies for one sort of energy or another. I think those are misguided, but if you look at the plan, they are a very small part of the plan.
Well, they actually are a very big part of the plan. Anyway, I'll hang up.
That's fine.
Bye-bye.
Well, I think just not to belabor this point, but I think that some people would argue that here we've been talking about the problems that alternative renewable sources face, wind and solar, and they would argue that the reason that they're not competitive with gas and oil is that indeed the gas and oil industries have for a long, long time enjoyed the benefit of subsidies. And,
yeah, no, that's incorrect. But
you don't think that's not.
No, the subsidies in the various industries, by far the larger ones have gone to the alternative technologies per unit of output. I don't deny that virtually every industry in America has gotten or is getting right now some subsidies. That's absolutely true. But the main focus of subsidies have been in alternative technologies. The total Bush package of subsidies and incentives is about $10 billion. Over a number of years. Now, I'm against those subsidies and I'm against the incentives, but I think the $10 billion of taxpayer money is a lot less than the many in Congress want to spend on those subsidies, and it's a small price to pay for the hundreds of billions of dollars of private investment that will be encouraged by removing some of the regulatory bottlenecks that have been created. So it's essentially the Bush plan is saying spend $10 billion of taxpayer money and that will help us pass this plan, which will lead to hundreds of billions of dollars of private investment in new energy infrastructure, new pipelines, new power plants, new oil refineries.
Let's continue. We'll go next to Belgium, line number 3. Hello.
Yes. Listening to your comments here, and I'm just befuddled. Why he says that other individuals, we can't tell people to try to consume as possible. We feel, he seems as though he feels no moral responsibility to say, to slow this train down a little bit. But I just got to hang up.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I think you've talked about that a little bit. I don't know if you want to go any further on that point.
Well, no, I do think that it's an odd... feeling that is really right now is really strongly focused on the sort of totalitarian puritanical attitude is very strongly focused right now on energy use, that there's something sinful about it. Even using any energy is somehow wicked, and the more you use, the more wicked you are. I just don't see it. We're not running out of energy. It's not some magic substance. It's part of the resources of the world. It would be like saying we should force everyone to lose weight. You know, should the government coerce weight loss? We are the most obese nation in the world. We eat too much. Should the government pass laws that say you can only consume, 2,200 calories a day? I don't think so. I think that's authoritarian and repulsive.
Well, just a quick, for example, a lot of people on the environmental side say one thing that would be very simple that we could do that would save us a lot of energy would be to mandate an increase in fuel efficiency for cars and trucks. And for example, they say if on SUVs that don't now have to meet the standards for cars, if we just increase their mileage by 3 miles a gallon, we would save... Our consumption, oil consumption, would drop by 49 million gallons a day.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with the mandate that says to the people who make cars and trucks, we expect you to increase the mileage that your vehicles get?
Well, I think that's a good example of the problem. There are trade-offs in every area, and forcing people into smaller cars. That get better gas mileage will improve our it will reduce the amount of petroleum consumed by automobile travel, but again it takes power out of the hands of people and puts it in the hands of government that knows best. The fact is that there are trade-offs between fuel efficiency, for example, and safety. Larger cars are safer than smaller cars, on average. I'm not saying every large car is safe and every small car is unsafe, but there is a direct connection between the size of the vehicle you're traveling in and the safety of it. Many people value safety over saving gas. The reason SUVs have become so popular is because of the CAFE standards. The CAFE standards applied to automobiles have been ratcheted down so much that basically big cars and station wagons in particular, companies can't offer them. I mean, Volvo offers big cars, big heavy cars, but they have to pay a penalty every year to the government because they don't meet the automobile fuel efficiency standard. The big automakers want to meet those standards, and so they have gotten rid of station wagons. They don't sell them anymore. Instead, they call them SUVs. A lot of people need larger automobiles. They have family members, they have children, they have their elderly parents living with them. They need larger cars. Forcing them to pay a whole lot more in order to get one of those cars, because the way the fuel efficiency standards work is that it doesn't mean that big cars can't be made. It just means that a lot fewer of them can be made. And if you make a lot fewer, you'll have much higher prices for them. Forcing people, for instance, to drive two cars wherever they want to go, strikes me there's something wrong about that. And so I think there are trade-offs whenever the government intervenes and interferes in the choices that consumers make, and we should allow consumers to have a wider choice of products and services, not a narrower choice.
I really should give more time to callers here because we're getting short on time. And really quickly, again, let me introduce our guest. We're speaking with Myron Ebel from the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. We'll continue here. Our next person in line is Urbana, line one. Hello?
Yeah, your guest says he doesn't understand what the difference would be with this product consuming energy than it would be in others. Well, the key problem is that the impact of waste products is just not being received by either the public properly or the industry for sure. And it's kind of a, from an engineering sense, it's kind of a feedback problem. And it's exemplified by the way you put down the scientific consensus. Another thing, when you say the free enterprise, I'm almost completely certain that you don't mean that, for example, labor would have a powerful say-so in the economy, which is my definition of true free enterprise, because if so, they certainly would be against the reprocessing of nuclear fuel that Bush is so much for. There was someone just on this radio station yesterday who pointed out that not only would the reprocessing of the nuclear fuel be dangerous for workers, but if you create plants to take up this reprocessed nuclear fuel, that it involves liquid waste, which is far more dangerous for both workers and the environment. And another thing is that when you're so for free enterprise, but are you willing to pay Brazil for keeping its Amazon jungle pristine and undeveloped? Because we are certainly benefiting from the oxygen produced by the Amazon, and I don't hear any company anywhere suggesting we should pay them. But I've got a question, and you can obviously...
And you can help us by being quick because we're getting really short on time.
Whatever happened to using the rest of the world's resources before our using our own? I mean, fossil fuels are a lifeblood issue, and it's as if I had a pacemaker and there were only so many batteries in the world. I would buy up those from other countries before using up the ones in my own country. Whatever happened to using up the rest of the world's resources before using our own? I'll hang up and let you go. Thanks.
Well, of course, there's the global market in energy, and we import 55% of our petroleum. We import little of our coal because we have hundreds and hundreds of years of coal supply. I'd like to get back to an earlier comment he made, which was about pollution, and I would just reiterate what I said before. The quickest way to improve the environment is to increase wealth. The countries that have the worst pollution problems are very poor countries like India. India, the per capita electricity consumption per year is somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 kilowatt hours. our electricity production is per capita is somewhere in the neighborhood of 13,000 kilowatt hours, but we have much, much less pollution than they do in India. We don't burn dung for inside our house to cook our daily meals. We don't have anywhere near the sort of air pollution, water pollution, soil pollution that they do. So if we can help them get wealthier, they will be a much healthier, more environmentally inviting place to live.
We'll try and get at least one more, another Urbana caller right here, line two. Hello.
Hello. On the subject of subsidies, I simply have to go back to the oil depletion allowance, which it seems to me is the largest energy subsidy of all and probably dwarfs all subsidies ever given to alternative sources of energy.
Mr. Ebel?
No, we disagree, but I don't think we have time to go through the add up the numbers. There are many subsidies for the problem with government when you decide that one industry should be favored and should get a subsidy because they are somehow morally superior, their product or the way they do business is morally superior to another product. The problem is that then every other industry wants to come in and get a subsidy from the U.S. taxpayers. And we have this now.
You haven't answered the question.
No, well, yes, I disagree. No, the oil depletion allowance is not the largest subsidy per capita production of per BTU produced. It is not.
I guess that, again, there are some people who would say on this whole issue, and I know you have said that you disagree with the point of view, but that when it comes to the petroleum industry in this country, that we've made the decision not because we think that it's morally superior, but we made the decision that particularly because of ties between people in politics and people in the business, that this is the source of energy that we're going to back.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that some people, there's a great wave of cynicism out there in the country that says, well, we shouldn't be surprised that this administration will be so supportive of these sources of energy because the vice president and the president and other members have ties to the industry.
Well, of course, this is, I think, a misunderstanding. The oil industry, and this could be said of any industry that's producing energy, they are making higher profits on their capital investments now because of shortages than they are ever going to make once more abundant and affordable energy is provided because of the Bush plan. I would expect that return on capital will go down as we build new power plants, new oil refineries, new natural gas pipelines. These efforts are directed at benefiting consumers who need more energy. Our energy consumption, our energy demand is going up. It's been going up at a fairly good clip for a long time, and we haven't been building and rebuilding our energy infrastructure. And consequently, we have electricity shortages, we have natural gas shortages, and we have a wide variety of gasoline shortages because we have all these different environmental mandates for each area of the country. But I doubt that the profits of the big energy companies will be as high once there's more abundant energy supplies in this country than there is now.
Hmm.
It's in their interest, it's in their shareholders' interest to have shortages. That's why they can sell this electricity to California for marginal rates that are, you know, unbelievable.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
sure.
I'm afraid we're at the end of the time. We're going to have to stop. And also, my thanks to the callers and also my apologies to people who couldn't get in. I'm sure we will continue to talk about these issues in future programs, but for the moment, we got to leave it there and say to you, Mr. Ebel, thank you very much
thank
for talking
you,
with us. Our guest, Myron Ebel, he's Director of Global Warming and International Environmental Policy with the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C.